Welcome to In Conversation With from the Devon and Plymouth Chamber of Commerce. Supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors. Presented by Stuart Elford. Recorded at Fresh Air Studios in Plymouth.
Hello there, I'm Stuart Elford, Chief Executive of Devon and Plymouth Chamber of Commerce, with another edition of our In Conversation With podcast. I'm actually joined today by two friends, which is going to be a bit sort of weird because I'm interviewing people I actually know instead of people I don't. And today I am joined by Eleanor Eaton and Dawn Melville, currently from Micronomy. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
I don't know why I'm a bit scared now. I'm scared. It should be the other way around. You should be terrified of what I'm going to ask you. Actually, I'm a bit scared.
We are.
I've known you both in various guises over the years, but your current guise is Micronomy, and it's a relatively new business, isn't it? I think it's only fair to give you a sort of one-minute elevator pitch to tell us what is Micronomy. I'm really struggling today. I don't know. I think I'm going to have a slurp of coffee while you tell us what Micronomy is.
So we've only got a minute.
Well,
this is going to be a challenge.
Go for it. Well, you're going to have 30 seconds each.
Oh, there you go. We'll share.
You start. We'll see how we get on.
Okay. Yep. Basically, Micronomy was born because for our whole profession, we have both worked in around projects that we've been really proud of, that we've been really excited by, that have made a massive difference, that have in some way carved a better tomorrow than today. And we've really loved that. What we were slightly frustrated by is the fact that a lot of these projects had a premature full stop because of funding. And what we wanted to do is look at the micro interactions to help make the big things happen, rather than chasing the big pots of money, the big contracts, looking at what we can do in the micro sense to make big things happen.
See, that was some pitch. By micro, do you mean micro as in business? When you talk about micro interactions, is that very small business? Or?
So micro interactions can be a conversation, an introduction, a single email. It can be a big project of work where we look at the micro elements of what we need to do in order to get to the end. So for us, the micro is just making sure that we concentrate on all the rich, juicy, great stuff in the middle of the beginning and the end.
With my Lord Sugar hat on,
yes,
I struggle to see the business model in that. How do you make money out of micro interactions?
Well, we're basically like a consultancy in a lot of ways,
right,
or an agency in others, would you say?
Definitely. There's a couple of strands. So we've got like business development. We can either work with emerging talent, which we do an awful lot of work with Arts University and Plymouth University and Coventry University, various universities, to try and help seed a city with talent, because with my past hats on, that's part of what I've been doing, same with Eleanor along the way. And so we want to continue that, but that's obviously not a great business model because people just starting out don't have cash.
No, we've noticed that.
But what we do is we find opportunities and challenges that large organisations are facing, and then we align them. So we're that bit in the middle where small interactions between one particular group and another, and when brought together, can create some really interesting outputs that we then are more involved in from a funding perspective. We can put some funding in to continue the project, or we get paid by the organisation. Or, for example, we are one of those agencies, the models where, because we've done so much work in the city in particular, and we've got such strong networks, if people don't know where to go, they start with us. And then we can either take on that piece of work or we pipeline it out to our network. So micro pieces of work go in all directions, but we sort of manage that process. So project management, business development, a lot of it is around the challenges that organisations, individuals or the city faces. And we look for those. We actively go looking. So we're quite proactive in picking up work, prototyping and developing and ideating projects that we then go and partner with organisations to bring the funding in to develop them. So we do a lot of work. We self-start a lot of stuff. So instead of waiting for the funding to land, we find opportunities that we can see that actually by bringing the right people to the table, bringing the right talent to the table, starting the right conversations in the right place, we can generally get from A to B in slightly smaller steps and wait for a large bit of funding to land. So there is a business model. We're never going to be millionaires, but we are going to be happy doing what we do.
This time next year, Rodney. And some of that, I guess, is why Micromingles came about. Do you want to talk about Micromingles?
Eleanor and I are also associate lecturers. A big part of what we do and have been doing is how do we seed the city, like I said earlier, with talent? Because once it stays, then other talent stays. And then you build this kind of rich, more fertile kind of environment for creativity to take place, or digital. So my background is in digital. Some of my students from way back when, about 14 years ago when I started, set up, started to seed the city with their businesses because they stepped out. of the module that I taught, set up businesses, and then I gave them work, and that's sort of how it perpetuated. And they went on to set up Digital Plymouth. So you can see how quite quickly you can build a community. We're looking at it at the creative sense now. But what we did find is that a lot of this emerging talent and small business community didn't feel as comfortable accessing events and activities that are currently held for like corporates or large organisations. Yeah. And in talking to them about why they didn't feel comfortable, it just didn't feel like it was in a language that they understood, in a format that they felt that was approachable or accessible, or whether it was for them at all. So Micromingles is looking at the chamber, what the chamber offers, because as a member of the chamber, we obviously go to all of your events and we can see the format. But I think there's a stepping stone before they access all your current activities and events, as with other organisations, that gets them more comfortable with even networking as a starting point, and where it's more conversational between the attendee and the people that were delivering the event, rather than sort of speaker and you're sat down in a space. So it's kind of just changing up the format a bit to make it more accessible and more a space and place where they can find their own community before they start to access all the other agency that's available.
Yeah, we talk about cheers and challenges as well. Yeah. So share their little celebrations, but also their challenges.
Yeah, and I think that it's really important for small and micro businesses to have that playground and that platform and that springboard that connects them with their next steps, which aren't necessarily what the larger organisations need. And we've been working a lot with the micro and the kitchen table businesses that have evolved through COVID and people turning their passions into a profession. And not necessarily being entrepreneurial in the business sense, but just being in pursuit of opportunity and really looking at how they can craft something which they might not want to necessarily scale up and grow massively, but it sustains their lifestyle. Mm. And we've been asking them what spaces and places they want to occupy and what sort of people they want to meet. And it's all been about them being able to have conversations with people and sharing their vulnerabilities, seeing who else has come up against the same barriers, but also better understanding and being better connected to the city and the city's DNA to know strategically where they fit and what conversations they can be having. Micromingles is that space, that platform and springboard that connects everyone to new opportunities, but also new networks that they wouldn't otherwise have been connected to.
Yeah, and I'm really, really grateful for your help and that of, we should say, DBI, Diversity Business Incubator, also partnering on it, because I was aware as a chamber with, I hope, okay, good, at delivering support, thank you, to businesses that pay us, but we're not really supporting the next generation of businesses, and we're not reaching out to those communities that are harder to reach, that I don't know about. I'm good at talking to the people we know, but not the people we don't know. So I was grateful for that and for the approach, which is a different approach.
It really feels different, doesn't it? Yeah. And I'm really excited by it. And I think it's that thing where we have an ocean in the city which is full of richness, and we have amazing big organisations, but we also have amazing small organisations. And it's very easy to be able to find and monitor and measure the larger organisations because you know how and where to find them, whether that's through Companies House or whether that's through, you know, being part of the chamber or those larger activities. But to be able to fish and find the smaller organisations that aren't necessarily incorporated or part of the normal mailing lists that businesses are involved in, it's really hard to find them and really hard to hear their voices. So hopefully what Micromingles will do for us as a city is not only to be able to identify who those kitchen tables, micro amazing startups are, but to be able to have a two-way conversation and engage with them, which is really powerful.
Well, that's where Blue put me in my place, wasn't it? So Blue is a young lady you brought to the initial meeting when we were talking about this, and typical Stuart, thinks he knows what he's doing, right? We're going to stand at the front and transmit at you about how great the chamber is and how we can help you with all your problems. And I've never been more appropriately challenged or told I'm wrong by Blue, who basically said, well, if you do that, you get what you've always got. Yeah. What about if you just listen to them for a change? I mean, she put it far more eloquently than me, but about listening to them about their cheers and challenges. You know, what are they proud of? Give them that space.
She's also partnered with us on the Micromingle development. So it's the Chamber, DBI, Blue Illustrates and Micronomy, because without the voice of the community we're trying to engage with, we won't get it right. We don't even have all the answers. So we're in a similar position to you. We've taken advice from those that will hopefully be attending. What's really interesting, and pulling it even further back to, I mean, we don't just work with graduates or students. We work with anybody that's sort of entrepreneurial. We bring industry in to do like a challenge module that we run, and we put a live brief on the table and the students have to meet with the client and go through that whole process. And the feedback we've been getting is that they didn't realise how accessible and approachable people from industry were. Mm. They didn't see you as like just everyday people. They get this kind of perception that they're going to talk to the CEO of this company and they won't know how to talk to them. And actually, what's been really interesting, and we hope Micromingles will do the same thing, is it will make everybody aware that we're all just
humans
in different roles.
Yeah.
We're all having bad days at one point or another, you know, and it's that kind of sense that actually you should be able to feel okay to approach a CEO in a company as much as you are approaching through like an administrator or a secretary. The conversations can be at the same level, and it's just raising confidence in the ability to walk into a space and not feel like you don't belong.
I think that's really important, and Blue helped me to see that, that I was delivering in the wrong way and communicating in the wrong way. But she wrote me the loveliest letter afterwards, made me cry, saying about how inclusive I was and how welcoming and how I'd let her have her voice, why have you. So it was really lovely. I got absolute joy from that, and we're going to be working more closely with Blue and hopefully with you guys.
Yeah. What was interesting is before we went into that meeting, I said to Blue, right, we're just here to listen. Neither I nor Blue have ever been able to not talk. And I was all raring to go after you were saying something. I was like, we're just listening. And then she just let loose, and then it was closely followed by me going, yeah, exactly what Blue's saying.
Yeah.
And the whole meeting was dominated, but it was the right thing to do. And everybody was very gracious in being able to take on board the points that Blue was making, that it just doesn't work. She would not be interested in coming, and she represents the people we're trying to talk to.
But it was done so appropriately. Like I said, I've never been more appropriately challenged and told I'm wrong. And it was like, yeah, I am. I'm wrong. Sorry. I just need to note the date and time. Me saying I'm wrong very rarely happens, by the way, because it's so rarely happened. There must be like an eclipse or something at the same time.
We need that to be snipped out as a social media.
Stuart Elford admits he's wrong. Date, time, place.
That
anyway, sorry. No, yeah, shut up, because Eleanor was saying something very important about me being right.
What I think is really powerful is the people that we work with, the people we partner with, the people we co-create and collaborate with, are all people who are really happy to come off their scalextrics and listen to new things, listen to new voices. And that's been a really heartening thing, hasn't it?
It's a lot of generosity in the city, which I don't think a lot of people, well, maybe a lot of people are aware of it if they're receiving it.
Mm.
But as a new sort of startup, there is a lot of generosity and kindness in the city, but they just don't know how to plug in. That's all it is. It's a handhold to a point where they feel like they can then continue.
So. And it's so easy for a narrative, especially for students or people who are new to the area. It's so easy to adopt that narrative or that story about all of the challenges that we have here in our city.
Mm.
And all of the barriers that we have and a lot of negativity. But actually, when you look through a different lens and you see the city, I think we're really good as a city at putting a lens over it for the world to see how great we are. But maybe there's a little movement that's required for us to put a lens over the city for people in the city to see how great we are. And I feel that Micromingles and the relationships that are being cultivated at the moment with those small companies, I think that's a really great step towards Plymouth being a place that's seen as a playground for pilots and prototypes.
That's one of the things we started off with. How do we make this a place and space where you can prototype and fail and test stuff? And that's okay. It's supported. It's actively encouraged to be entrepreneurial and to kind of take risks. And if you can do it here, pretty much do it anywhere, I reckon.
Yeah,
that's what I think with Plymouth.
For some, doing
I mean, I'm ready to go.
And Well,
she's got
go for it.
She
she's got
sing.
A microphone, she'll go. You're not averse to that. You've done a bit of stand-up, haven't you?
Well, that was my last piece of exciting, like, never guess what. But yeah, I did. I have a real fear of standing up in front of people and talking, which is bizarre because I'm a lecturer. But it still makes me feel very uncomfortable. I was given the opportunity to go up to Soho for a weekend and do a whole comedy weekend and learn from the experts and a club in Soho. And I went up with another colleague you might know, Katie Tokus, or Mama Tokus.
Mama Tokus,
to many people. And she's a funny girl, but I'm funnier.
As it turns out.
Modest too.
Who would know? And I thought I'd be really uncomfortable. Well, the reward was the self-satisfaction of knowing that you spent 48 hours, whatever it was, learning all these different ways to do comedy, write it, perform it, you know, take on a character. None of that works for me. All I've got is a very dark background through which a lot of humour has risen. And they gave us right at the end half an hour to write down some comedy that we had to perform. I couldn't write a thing. And I'm sat next to a journalist, Katie, who's scribbling away her life story. And I thought the only way I can do this and save face is to just go first. And luckily, in between walking from my seat to the stage, I remembered something which I'm not sure I'm going to tell you on camera. a story from my family that I managed to deliver, laugh my way through it because it just suddenly came to me. And at the end, they said, I've got very awkward delivery, a funny accent, but I was definitely the funniest. So I'll take that. You've got to take your small win to where you can. But for me, I'd actually stood up and done comedy in Soho in front of a crowd. Even for as short a time as it was, that was for me a massive win.
The conversation continues shortly. But first, Stuart Elford and the Chamber of Secrets.
It sounds like we should have sort of thunder, lightning sort of thing going on. Is that people have suggested questions that are either funny, embarrassing or whatever. And we've put them in a very odd looking box, which is now in front of my guest. And I'm going to ask Susie, Plymouth Comedy Tour Susie. Hi, Susie.
Hello.
In a minute, I'm going to ask you to open the box and reveal the questions and then answer the embarrassing thing. But you've got to do it honestly. Russell, Russell, pull out a question.
Do you have an innie or an outie? An innie.
Innie.
Quite a deep one.
A deep innie. Do you know, we'd asked a lot of people about this and suddenly somebody said, are you talking about Brexit? No, I'm talking about your belly button. Anyway, right. So,
You get a snack in mine.
You get... Well, that conjures an image. Right, Susie, funny woman. Draw. What is the question?
What was your nickname at school? Well, my name is Susie Bennett, so I often would get, oh, have you got a brother called Gordon? Bennett Bentit. People would say Bennett Bentit.
Bennett Bentit.
I had a proper... I did used to get called Podge. But that's another story for my therapist.
Yeah.
I got called Podge a few times.
Oh, now I want to cry.
I was called Miss Benet in my teenage years because of keeping up appearances. Myself and my friends,
Bucket and Bouquet,
we decided to posh up our names. So I was Miss Benet for all my time at Butlins and years later. And even my email address is Miss Benet. So
Miss Benet.
I still get that sometimes.
Okay.
Which
well,
I quite like.
I tell you what.
If I'm doing a posh gig, say in Ivy Bridge, I'll be Susie Benet instead of Susie
Benet.
Bennett.
Is it Ivy Bridge posh, is it?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Anyway, right, Susie, thank you so much for so honestly answering those questions. You may put them back in the box for some poor other soul
yes,
to pick
I'll
up.
Them up.
And thank you very much for revealing your chamber secrets.
Follow the Devon and Plymouth Chamber of Commerce on X at @chamber_Devon and search for us on LinkedIn. Make sure you don't miss out on future episodes. Hit subscribe now. In conversation with... supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors. Now, back to the conversation.
I genuinely mean this, not trying to be funny myself, that you've always tackled things with humour. Well, you have, haven't you? And you've also spent a lot of your career helping people. And you mentioned that it comes from a dark place. Is that why you think you want to help people and be funny? Just to...
Yeah. We won't go into too much detail, but my childhood was tricky and it was always about raising people's mood. So I've got sisters, you know, I've got a single mum, and a lot of the time it was about doing that. And also I went to quite a difficult school, and if you were the class joker, you avoided the class fights that were quite regular. You know, you find your place by being the class clown or by being the comedian and finding the funny in things, that people just let you move through life. You know, you can kind of be that person they always want with them because you can bring the mood up. But you tend to find it takes a lot out of you
yeah,
at times. It can be exhausting. So what you see on the front might not be what you get behind the scenes. But I find that when it's been challenging conversations that I've had to have with my mum and my sisters of matters from my past, in order to be able to even go on to the subject matter, we've had to do it through finding a funny thing, because that allowed us to then open up the conversation about the dark thing. So I think, I don't know whether there's a psychology in that. My sister is a psychologist, so obviously there's some rationale as to why I went into helping people and she went into helping people in a different way. There's probably something in that. And I love my sister's dark sense of humour as much as I love my own, which is still the best.
Clearly.
And,
it's
you know,
winning, apparently.
And I think it's healthy to find the funny, because life throws you some real curveballs and you've got to be able to just go, oh God, this is just a joke, like literally, rather than I can't take this anymore. So I can make light of stuff probably that shouldn't be made light of, but there's been a lot that's happened that's helped with that.
Well, Ricky Gervais said, if you can't laugh at the bad stuff, then the bad stuff wins.
Yes, exactly.
You know, you've just got to find a way to laugh because of the ridiculousness of it. It's like the dark humour in the police ambulance service and what have you, because if you hear it out of context, it's perhaps not funny or appropriate.
Yeah.
But the context is what makes everything, isn't it? Yeah. It's just, you know, if you can't find something to laugh about, that's what being human's about, isn't it?
Yeah. A
bloody good laugh.
And it makes others around you feel comfortable about the subject matter as well. Because I work with, or we both work with young people who are very challenged with maybe like neurodiversity or mental health, more so than they've ever been. Sometimes it's good to meet them at a level where it's just kind of safe ground. So you're not coming in as teacher, that kind of different dynamic. You're just like, how's your day been? And then we can have a joke about something. And then suddenly you've got a conversation opener that allows them to maybe open up a bit more. And then you can work with their rhythm to get them through the day, because otherwise you just, they switch off and you've lost them. And I think that's the same with a lot of young people. If you can find a point at which they can open up, it generally is just having a bit of a giggle about something or finding something that's a bit funny or a little bit sideways in that whole conversation or space, rather than just going in as like teacher parent.
That's a lesson for everyone though, isn't it? Not just in lecturing, not just in parenthood.
I was gonna say, it's not just young people, is it?
No, it's not. And I think that if we all allowed the time, whether it's in our workplace or in our home life, because I think that's what Dawn does really well as well, is she spots the rhythm that someone's coming in at, the mood they're coming in at, and she meets that, but then she knows what to do to push, tickle, pull, poke it in whatever direction it needs to go.
Yeah.
And I think that brings comfort. That brings the ability for people to lean into an experience and an opportunity.
That's funny. So I had a sergeant back in the police years ago who described me as a social chameleon. I thought it was an insult until he explained what he meant. He meant you just find a way to speak to people. You know, in the morning I'd met Princess Anne, and in the evening I'm dealing with some drug addict who's upset because his girlfriend's having an affair or something. And he said, you just find a level. And
Did you just name drop then? Princess Anne.
I might have just dropped in about Princess Anne.
I mean, I played drums for Princess Edward.
Drums for Prince Edward?
Yes.
Come on, bring it on. You've got to finish that story.
I mean, it was me and about 100 other people in the band.
Steel drums?
I was at the front, dressed as a little boy, because apparently the girls couldn't be in the Marine Cadet Band. Well, we could, but as long as we looked like little boys. But yeah, that was a while ago. I worked at the Herald's as a sub-editor, and you just give the headline with no context. It makes the story so much more interesting. I played drums for Prince Edward there. Nobody needs to know the details.
You were a journalist. I think the art of headline writing is brilliant. One of my favourite headlines ever was the pensioner survives 100-foot drop into glass of water. And it was a story about an old guy turned his tap on and a centipede dropped out. And I just thought, what brilliant sort of headline writing that was.
We had so little time to write headlines. And it was always like, if you could get that on point, that was the absolute skill. Actually, I did a lot of the humour headlines, because a lot of the stories were quite dark at the Herald. It was either Czech presentations or murder. There was not much in between when I was there. But newspapers were very different. And they had the printing press at the Herald. So it was like you had deadlines. It wasn't all automated and there was no internet. So headlines meant something back then. Obviously, nowadays, you can get news immediately to any phone from anybody. So it's not quite the same.
Yeah. In my time dealing with Harold, I was obviously on the other side dealing with all the murder stuff.
I know,
hence that dark humour again. Yeah. I was just thinking, you were talking about vulnerability. I think it's really important to be able to be vulnerable. I didn't. We had an event at the Chamber where we were talking about men's mental health.
Mm.
And at the time, I had a friend staying with me who was staying with me because he was suicidal.
Mm.
And he'd worked out he was going to kill himself. He had more than prepared. I mean, there was a whole thing. And I started to talk about it because the subject came up about men's mental health. So I started talking about how important it was to talk about me. I didn't particularly mention my friend. And I started crying in front of 100 people. And I sort of pulled myself together. I'm very embarrassed. And afterwards, I had people coming up to me saying, that was so powerful. Oh, to see a leader being vulnerable and, oh, you've really made a difference. And I was thinking, well, it's not why I did it, but it just was interesting that being vulnerable.
And it's so important for people to be brave, bold and curious enough to be vulnerable, because it unlocks so much more for others as well, doesn't it? We are working on a project called Talk and Tinker, and that's specifically about men's health and how we really empower and enable people. So we have a female version as well, but how we empower and enable people to just find themselves and meet themselves someplace that feels comfortable, where they can be vulnerable in a way that is safe. You know, because a lot of the time it can feel quite hostile talking about your feelings, and especially in business, being vulnerable, not being
as a failure rather than just success, it's important to get all
that balance.
Well, it's interesting. So I had some life coaching, and my life coach asked me why I wouldn't be emotional in front of my board or in front of people. And I said, because it's weak. Why would I do that? Why would I share that? And it's interesting that having then done it kind of accidentally, if you own it, it's really powerful. The event went on to talk about men's mental health. And I was saying that, you know, you need to speak to someone. And I just thought it was appropriate to share that not that long ago, I'd found myself in bed crying, unable to get out of bed because I'd hit a wall and I'd gone into a real pit of depression and anxiety. And it was awful. I was having anxiety attacks. I couldn't function. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. It was absolutely awful. I felt like the world was collapsing on me. So I mentioned it and I said, look, if me as a 6'2" ex-policeman can stand in front of you all and say, not that long ago, this was happening to me. Yeah. And if you talk to someone, it will get better, you know, reach out to. And then I realized that because I own it, it doesn't matter now. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. If I thought, oh, someone might find out that I kind of had this depressive episode, they'd have power over me.
Yeah,
but to say, yeah, I did. So what? Brilliant. I'm so much healthier now because I've dealt with it.
It's like opening the curtains in a window, isn't it? The glass is still there to protect you. You're not being completely vulnerable, but you're letting the light in, which is really important. And then the impact that has on the people around you who are able to do the same. And just shows that we are all human.
Part of what we've been brought in when we've worked with different people is about our lived experience. So we do mentoring, we do business support, but we're very open about we've tried and failed at this. And this is why we talk through something with complete authenticity and honesty, because actually, like you say, they'd find out anyway, or it doesn't matter. There's no shame.
It's part
in saying,
of our DNA.
Yeah, there's no shame in saying, you know, we might have tried that formula and it totally doesn't work for these reasons. This is where it went wrong. And I think that helps. It helps people fast track past the bits that maybe could be challenging or will be problematic for them in the future. We're really honest. We won't take money off anybody if it's not going to work. It's not about just doing the job for the sake of it. It's making sure that it has value for everybody involved.
So it's interesting. So the American business culture, if you go for a job as a CEO, if you haven't failed at something, they're a bit suspicious of you. You know, have you not been brave enough?
Yeah.
You know, why wouldn't you do it?
Yeah,
interesting.
It's like lenders, though, isn't it? If you haven't ever gone into debt, they don't like to lend money to you.
That reminds me of the thing about banks are the institutions that will lend you money if you can prove you don't need it.
Yeah.
I'm not being rude to any bankers out there.
Scratch that.
Yeah. How many members have I got? Yeah, funny enough, you just said some really eloquent thing there about letting the light in. And that reminded me that you actually blog semi-professionally. You write a blog and you talk about health, well-being, mindfulness, all sorts of stuff. And you meditate.
I do.
Still an hour and a half a day?
An hour and a half a day. Yeah, every day. The blog came about in a couple of different kind of roundabout ways. One was when I had my son, I sold my business and we moved back to Plymouth. I'm a Plymouth girl, but I moved away for a while.
How dare you?
I know. But I was born in Freedom Fields. Whatever you say it, other people do. There's like a community of you, isn't there? And I just needed some extra money was basically what it was. And there was an editor that I knew and I sent him some writing that I had done previously, which had come about because I journal a lot. So I had sent off this piece and he said, look, would you be interested in ghostwriting? So I did some ghostwriting for some D-list celebrities.
D-list?
Yeah, they were back when reality TV was just kind of starting.
Right.
I would write pieces for them in a sponsorship piece. So if, you know, a company selling yoga mats wanted them to write a blog on yoga, I would write it and put their name to it. And then I just really found the whole process of writing and journaling almost like a kind of therapy. And it was allowing things to come out and make room in my mind for new things. And it felt really cathartic. So I carried on. And then I decided one day that I was going to build a website and start blogging. And so I did. And I have been ever since. And it's taken a number of different guises, but it's always been inside the mind of Eleanor. It goes back to what Dawn was saying about being authentic and vulnerable. And my motto since a very young age has been about being brave, bold and curious. And it kind of threads all of those things into each post that I put up, because it just makes you feel like you are open enough to share the truth. And the truth is really impactful, not only for you as the person sharing it, but I think also for the person reading it to realize they're not alone. And that's what we all want. We all want to feel like we're part of something.
We talk about being part of the Chamber family. I think
exactly.
A lot of
people
join because they want to belong to something. So inside the mind of Eleanor, I think if there was an inside the mind of Stuart, that would be quite scary. I don't think people want to know what's going on inside my mind.
I don't know. I don't know. I'd be quite intrigued.
Really?
Yeah.
Not sure.
Where's the alcohol?
So I think our listeners can know that we have shared the odd glass of wine
at times.
And some things have come out that are quite extraordinary that cannot be discussed on a
Thank
podcast.
Goodness you said that. I was wondering where you were going.
Yeah, well, you know, that brand envelope stuff that Cash you gave me at the start.
Good. Was paid. It's paid my due.
I think that's one of the first times that I met you. 20 years ago, I set up my business, Motion Graphic, which is a digital business. We set up a last Friday, which was a bit like a micro mingles, which was a conversational space for creatives and people to kind of just turn up to, so I could get to know who was in the city and how could I work with them really quickly, because you only have so many hours in a day. And you used to come along to that because you've had quite a few hats on since I've known you.
Yeah.
And you're always quite easy to position on tables with people that might have felt a little bit anxious about being there, like creatives that were just sort of emerging. And the whole premise of that activity was to just be the host, where you would know that actually there's a photographer come in, there's a graphic designer over there. If you sit these people together, it'll start conversations that might lead to, you know they're looking for funding or they're looking for partners. And part of that has fed over into the micro mingles, in the sense that there will be hosts at these events to make sure that people are guided towards conversations and the right groups or people to be introduced to. But that's, I think, one of the first interactions I had with you, just when you were running a media company, I think. So it's interesting how you start off in a place that was kind of accessible for us to be in, to enable us to build our networks, and now we're at the other end trying to put a ladder down to bring people up through to do the same. So Plymouth's a cyclic city anyway. It comes around and around.
Plymouth's a village. You both got a reputation for what I call GSD, getting stuff done.
Glad you clarified. I need a tablet.
And you've had some interesting projects over the time. What's the most interesting one, or the one you're most proud of all your weird and wonderful projects?
I'm super proud of us and Micronomy. But outside of that, that's really interesting. I think what I'm proud of most is that I have always felt like I have been able to in some way make a difference. I started at a very young age. I mean, I was brought up by serial entrepreneurs. My mum and dad aren't together, but I was literally born an entrepreneur. I'm really proud of always following my instinct and being in pursuit of opportunity and being brave, bold and curious enough to follow that up. But I think working for the Theatre Royal was a moment in my life where I really felt like I was not only having and playing a role within the theatre in that moment in time, but I was also working with people who were building a lasting legacy for the city. So being involved in the theatre, being involved in the build of TR2. When I left the theatre, I was head of development, so I was doing all of the income generation activities. And just knowing the difference that an organisation like that was making in the city. And what's really difficult is the arts can be seen as a luxury, and there's a real disconnect with the arts and how we live our life. But actually, when you see it in action, when you're part of that process and you hear young people who have gone from the classroom to a stage and you say how proud you are of them, and they're like, no one's ever said they're proud of me. You know, when you see the magic that happens off the stage, it's phenomenal. But then also Real Ideas, I was super proud to be part of that organisation. And then the council, being part of Plymouth City Council during...
So everyone she's ever worked for.
I don't want to miss anyone else.
Just going to keep going with all the people.
No, I'm proud of everything.
Your mum, and I want to thank my agents and the people.
And Gaz.
And I'm going to cry.
The conversation continues shortly, but first, the 60-second charity pitch.
Hi, I'm Tanya Woodland. I'm the CEO at Jeremiah's Journey. Jeremiah's Journey supports children, young people and their families across Plymouth and the surrounding area after the death of someone special. We support around 350 individual children and young people a year, with wider beneficiaries of 2,000. And we support them through structured group therapy programmes, through memory days, through individual work, through family therapy. And throughout the time at Jeremiah's Journey, we help them to understand the grief that they're going through, to understand that grief journey, and to help them be able to get over a significant bereavement and look forward with hope. We'd be delighted to hear from anybody that thinks they can help us in any way, and especially somebody that might have been bereaved as a child themselves, because ultimately you're the best advocates for the work that we do.
Follow the Devon and Plymouth Chamber of Commerce on X at @chamber_Devon and search for us on LinkedIn. Make sure you don't miss out on future episodes. Hit subscribe now. In Conversation With, supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors. Now, back to the conversation.
This seems really vain now, because I'm not going to thank any organisation, although I've worked for quite a few, but
me.
Just all about me. I started Motion Graphic, we mentioned that, just after 2000, and it was before digital was a thing. So nobody had websites. We were the first female-led digital company in the Southwest. We had to educate people what digital could do for them, show them what a website was, and then get them to want a website, because I didn't see anybody else having one. And what I was able to do back then, which is what we try and talk to our students about, is find new ground and be excited about exploring it. So it was about exploration in the sense that it was all so new. I did like the first website for the pavilions, the first virtual tour for the Eden project, and they didn't know they needed these things, but then everybody got them. We sort of used that as a benchmark to take to like Cannes Multimedia Festival to show them what we did for Eden. And it was all really new tech. We'd buy the most high-end tech, so we were ahead of the curve. And our whole theory or our whole motto for Motion Graphic was just, what's the worst that can happen? Why don't we just try stuff? And we did an outside film festival, beaming light up onto buildings in 2007, did a big film event because they stopped teaching filmmaking in primary school. So we did a big film festival with the council for all the schools in the city with a big Oscar-style award ceremony where we had an Oscar winner handed out an award. Because if you don't ask, you don't get. And we could just keep asking for these things. And people were open to us being really risk-taking and cheeky and opportunist, and it brought quite a lot of richness to our job because we just didn't know what was going to come next as it all developed so quickly.
It was incredible to watch. I can remember you just got involved in everything. It was always different.
Exciting.
A bit like Ellie's bold. It was always bold.
Second job we got, we completely blagged this whole pitch. I mean, blagged, we were brilliant, but we were really unready for a £200,000 euro contract. I mean, euros had just come in. We were trying to do the conversion. We didn't even quite know how to convert to put this pitch together. And then we were working with 13 countries across the Mediterranean to build an ethnographer portal in 8 languages. Well, bearing in mind, technology's new, a portal's brand new. 8 languages, including Arabic, that's a challenge. And we got it. And for 10 whole minutes, I could not have been happier. And then for 10 whole days, I could not really get out of bed because I realised the gravity of the project we'd taken on with two of us to do this like international, huge, great, working in collaboration with the Metropolitan University in London. And one of the first meetings we had to do was in Gran Canaria with the partners from every country. And as we were sat down at this big board meeting table with our PowerPoint showing the tech that we weren't sure we could make, but we were definitely trying to promise them we could, the war broke out again in Iraq. Suddenly everyone from like Beirut and Palestine and all the countries that were sort of over in that direction had to get back before they shut the flight path. So it was not just a challenge. There was so many challenges, you know, like war had broken out. So how do we work with these partners? It was so much of a learning curve. After that, I thought, come on, just hit me with it. There's nothing that's going to be more challenging than that 2-year project was. And I really liked the fact that I took all those risks at a point in my life where it didn't make me feel like I was going to break out in a hot sweat or a panic. It excited me. So that's what we try and instill in people that are starting up. It's like you've really got to want to be an explorer, and you've got to try. And if it fails, that's fine too. And if you get the nerves, start. What I found with that, when I realised it was too much, we started talking to people and say, like, how could you help us with this? Because actually we're out of our depth. And everybody just got involved. So we were able to do more and more by just partnering up with people. You seem to be the person to talk to. How's about doing this? And if you do it with enough enthusiasm, you can enthuse other people to give you stuff for free. Free resources, free time. Always up for some free resources, anybody. Yeah. Shameless plug for Micronomy. You just got to ask.
Yeah. And we talked about it earlier. I think this part of the world is welcoming and people just want to lean in. You know, we hear it all the time. I've been involved with how we're going to roll out the next generation of the Britain's Ocean City brand. So we're not rebranding. It's just how do we now evolve that? And some of the words that come out, funny enough, one of them is bold and one of them is welcoming. Those are the two words that this part of the world has.
Also, doing it afraid. Like, for me, that's really powerful. it's really easy to put things off because you're too scared or fearful of something. But there's always an element in fear in anything that's new or different or coming off your natural scalextrics. There's always an element of fear. And I think with Micronomy, bringing it to the current day, when I've been in business before, I've always been on my own. I've never been in business with a business partner before. And what it allows me, from my perspective, being in business with Dawn and being in business with someone, is that when you feel slightly fearful, when you are slightly concerned, you've got a cheerleader by your side to cheer you on and catch you if you're a bit wobbly and vice versa. And I think in the Southwest, I feel like that's a really big thing. I think that people do it afraid, and there is an element in fear in a lot of the things that we do, but there's always cheerleaders around you to support you, which is really powerful and really amazing.
What do they say? Feel the fear and do it anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. Do it with
fear. That just reminded me of a thing that you allowed us to do with a group of young people that had come up with a safety app idea for young women.
Oh, I remember that.
And
yeah,
you allowed them to speak in front of your procurement sessions that you run through the
table. That changed their course.
But for them, they were so fearful and they were at the end. So great, make them wait until everyone else has spoke, builds the fear. But I was stood with them and I was saying to them, like, just own it. If you're going to read from your notes, just tell everyone you're going to read from your notes because this is an uncomfortable space for you. Mm. But making them wait till the end, so they had that kind of 10 minutes to talk to potential organisations that might be interested, they were able to see that actually lots of the people that went up the front who were CEOs of companies were really nervous. And actually they aren't. There's a difference between these guys that know what they're doing and you guys just starting out. Nobody really knows what they're doing. Nobody really has so much confidence in themselves that they haven't got a slight bit of nerves within them. But you put them at the front, you allowed them to have that space. They were really nervous. They spoke from their notes, but they started off by saying, we're digital. We don't usually get out from behind the screen. And they started it with humour, which I hadn't expected. And everybody was really receptive. And they got such a good amount of feedback in the network. And afterwards, they were so shocked that Babcock wanted to talk to them. And this company, you know, these big, giant, faceless organisations were actually really personable and
blown
interested.
Away by
It's breaking down that kind of sense that actually you can't have those conversations and they're really sorted and they know what they're doing. You know,
yeah, we're all
nobody
winging
does.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're all winging
so it. Everybody just needs to own it. Like I've stood in front of students before and said, I'm having a right wobble today because menopausal women, we get it now and again and I'm happy to let them see it because I can't hide the sweat. So I might as well just tell them what's happening. And I'm sure you don't mind me saying Ellen is diabetic. So sometimes she might be giving a lecture and I can see that I should probably take over because, you know, she needs to kind of step out. And it's much better to tell the students that that's what's happening because they are so much more open to anything that doesn't feel formulaic or it feels unstructured because it needs to be. And that's okay too.
Being authentic again.
It's just life.
This is a recent thing. Was it in January you were in a coma?
Yeah, end of January.
Yeek.
It is all relatively new and it was quite a big firework that went off in my world. But for a year, I was kind of feeling not quite myself, just very tired and genuinely thought I was just perimenopausal because it was all of the symptoms that I was getting. I filed it away in my head and parked it as I'm perimenopausal. That's fine. I know what it is. I'm going to crack on. And then doctors also confirmed that. So I was like, okay, this is my route. This is my journey. This is my path. I'm going to deal with this
Welcome
the best
the
way I can. And then I actually went on holiday with my mum in September last year. And you know how mums, doesn't matter how old you are, my son's 22 and I still would probably treat him like a toddler. But my mum was just like, I'm really worried about you. You just don't look like your normal sparkly self. It's not just that you're tired. There's something not right. And then she stayed with me at Christmas, this Christmas, and she said, no, there's definitely something wrong. I'm really concerned. I'm really worried. Please, for me, do something. Yeah. So because it was my mum and because she's always been my scaffolding and she's always fixed things that she didn't even break, but just she was there. I went to the doctors, but beforehand, my uncle's a diabetic specialist or was a diabetic specialist, and we have type 2 diabetes in our family. So my uncle had got my mum a little prick test monitor for her every year just to check her levels. So she had checked mine and they were scarily high. Yeah. So I went with her marching me to the doctors on the Monday morning. And in the surgery, they did my glucose and my ketone readings. A kind of typical person's glucose reading should be around a 5 and maybe after eating like a 7. Mine were in the high 30s.
Oh my.
And my ketone levels were very high, teens. I had driven myself and my mum to the doctor's surgery, and the doctor said, okay, this is really serious. And I was like, no, it's fine. I'm all right. Honestly, I'm fine. I'm just tired. And she was like, no. I wasn't allowed to drive to the hospital. She said, I'm going to call you an ambulance. And I was like, no, I'll get a taxi. It'll be fine. So the whole time I was refusing to accept that anything was wrong. I was just tired. We had started a business. You know, our lives were quite hectic and busy. And I got into hospital and then I stayed there pretty much. And the next day I went into a coma. For me, it wasn't awful because I was out of it.
Yeah.
But my mum and my son, it was huge, and talking about resuscitating and everything like that. And then to hear afterwards that if I had been 3 days later, I would not have come out of the coma. I would not have left the hospital. My son would not have had a mum. It makes you reevaluate stuff. Yeah, thank you, mum, for sure. And she beats herself up because she's like, I should have taken you sooner. But everything happens for a reason, and I think it's timely.
I think it's a really important point you've reminded me of something. I think we should be not frightened to have discussions with other people about their health and to say you're worried about someone. I was on a Christmas walk must have been a year and a half ago, whenever, corporate walk. And one of the guys I've known for a long time, we went up a short incline and he was really puffing to get up the incline. And I said, are you all right, Brian? He doesn't mind me saying, because, and he said, yeah, I'm fine, just, you know, not very fit. And I said, you really are blowing there, mate. You ought to do something.
Yeah.
I thought no more of it. Fast forward about 6 months, I'm at an event, he's there. And as we left, he came and put his arm around me and he said, you saved my life. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, my wife had been telling me that I was puffing, but I was just telling her to leave me
amazing.
Alone.
Yeah.
He said, but because you said it, I went to the doctor. He said, I was in atrial fibrillation. The doctor said I could have gone within days.
Yeah. Wow.
And you think that's just by being rude enough to say, I don't think you're all right.
But I don't know if it's rude. I think it's more... It's caring.
British would say it's rude, but I think that's what I'm getting at. We need to be more caring. It's, forget the upsetting people. I'd rather upset you 10 times and save your life than think,
I can't possibly do that. Being upset that you might snap back at me, like, you know, all right, you keep having a go. You know, if you keep that persistence up, eventually they might sort of take that on board. But
I also think it's really important at this point, because it's something that I was reminded of not so long ago. I had my own business when I had my son, so I went back to work really quickly after having him, and I was fortunate enough to have him with me. And I can remember at that point someone saying to me, you're putting a huge amount of pressure on a lot of people by taking your son to work, going back to work so early, and different things. I've been really lucky that when this has all happened, we've had Micronomy and I've got people around me to support me. And the other day I caught myself saying, and I went back to work after 3 days. It's really bad of me to have been proud of that in that moment, because it's realizing that other people going through things, it might take them longer to get back to the norm than others. And you can't compare apples with oranges. You can't compare that I came out and went back to work to someone who came out and maybe needs 3 months off work. And I think that what's been really interesting for me on this journey is I've realised I really need to be busy in order for my mental health to be good. I really need to be able to get back. I needed to get back to work, and I needed to do what I care about and what I'm passionate about in order for me to get better. But I couldn't have done that without Dawn saying about, if, you know, I have that moment when I went back and I was probably back a bit too early and not used to my levels going high or low, and I don't really know how my body's reacting. Whereas Dawn can kind of spot it now before even I do, and she'll say, right, sit down. And people don't necessarily see that. They don't see the bad days that you have, or, you know, it's hard to get out of bed because you had a hypo or a hyper the day before. And I think it's really important that we talk about not only the positives, but also we have bad days too. I have bad days. Everyone has bad days. It's just very easy sometimes to see through the filter of social media the shiny, happy, good things. And again, it's about authenticity.
Well, they say, don't they, if only everyone's life was as good as it looks on social media.
100%.
We don't put on the bad stuff, we put on the good stuff. And I think we should sometimes share the bad stuff. And we should also remember that we're setting an example. So I had a nasty motorcycle accident almost exactly a year ago, and I had post-concussion syndrome, and I forced myself back to work. And a bit like you, I need to be busy, but I forced myself too hard. I was not in a good place at all, and that put strain on people around me. I had to apologise to my team for being grumpy and not myself and what have you. So I think sometimes we have a responsibility to those around us to show that actually we should just slow it down a bit.
Yeah,
you don't have to battle on.
And it's understanding that some people, it's not egoic and it's not about being a martyr. It's just that they need that kind of level of normality, especially when you've just been diagnosed with something which is, you know, forever.
It's out of your control, isn't it? So you start to try and control the environment in which it exists, the thing that's comfortable.
Well, we've had a wide-ranging
number
of subjects. Do you know what? It's really rare. I usually get to the end of these interviews. They sometimes are at 35, 40 minutes. And I've ticked off everything on my list I wanted to ask. We could have another whole interview with all the stuff I've still got. But unfortunately,
we can't. Is that you asking us to come back, though?
Well, maybe.
Just being polite.
You'll be the only guest who've appeared twice.
Oh, we'll swap seats so it'll feel different.
Well, I've got a whole load of interesting facts about both of you I didn't manage to get out.
Snowboarder, just put it in.
That you're a snowboarder, that you've only moved once in your entire life.
Through a hole in the wall.
3 yards that you moved next door.
I didn't even go out a front door. No. I went through a hole in the wall.
Whereas, Ellie, you've moved 16 times. Mm. Yeah, you see, all this stuff, we'll have to come back another time. I'm really grateful to you opening up about so much stuff in your lives, but also for the work you're doing with those micro businesses, for partnering with us on Micronomy, for giving people a chance. As you said, put that ladder down, help everyone else up. I think it's absolutely brilliant. So thank you, Dawn. Thank you, Ellie.
Thank you for having us.
Speak to you next time.
Yeah, thank you.
In Conversation With is supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors, helping with all your business and personal taxation needs. Westcott's, we're here. Produced by Fresh Air Studios. Full audio and video production services for business podcasts and corporate events. Visit freshairstudios.com. Presented by Stuart Elford. Produced by Paul Philpott. Edited and mixed by Martin Burgess-Moon. Video production by Mark Stevenson. Production support by Lisa Hartwell. Copyright Devon and Plymouth Chamber of Commerce and Fresh Air Studios Limited. All rights reserved.